chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Boy, we've got a lot going on the 7th of January. We had an attack on two locations in Paris, France, by jihadists. And one attack was on Charlie Hebdo. It was a magazine publishing office, and they killed approximately 10 people there. And then we had a further attack later that day. That occurred in the morning. We had another attack on a kosher food supermarket, or I guess market is what we would call it here. So those two attacks occurred on the same day, and they were linked eventually to the same cell of jihadists. The two attacks in Paris were connected eventually. There was an attack on Charlie Hebdo that began, and then it carried over to an attack on a supermarket or a grocery store that dealt in kosher types of foods in a Jewish area. The group they claimed responsibility for the two attacks was Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and said they had planned it for years. A couple of days later, the terrorists were tracked to an area there northeast of Charles de Gaulle Airport, and where they took a hostage, but later on that proved not to be correct. But anyway, they took out all the terrorists. There were people killed, there were a total of 17 people killed and about 22 wounded, and we don't have any updates on that. But there were two locations. One was at the magazine. And the terrorists in the Islam community has, what they're doing, what they're alleging is that this magazine besmirched and tried to destroy the image of their prophet Muhammad, and in a series of cartoons and so forth. And they depicted him in a very demeaning way, according to the Muslim followers and worshipers of Muhammad. And so as a result, then they went ahead and launched these the extremists that were connected with this launched these attacks, not only on the magazine, but also on the food market there. The Turkish president made a statement after this. Well, what happened immediately after that was that you had a great outpouring from all over Paris and throughout the nation, the French nation, of sympathy for those who had lost their lives at this magazine. And there was a big demonstration in downtown Paris, and there was 40 state leaders, heads of state, that joined hands. And they marched down the streets of Paris, and Netanyahu was right there in the middle of them all, along with Merkel and the French president Hollande. So, you know, they all joined hands, and they showed a unity of action there. There were problems earlier before they got there. It was reported that President Hollande did not want Netanyahu nor Abbas to come, but both of those were in the front line. And one publication in Israel actually, edited out, Merkel. Anyway, let me make a note here of some of what they were saying in this this article. This Israeli newspaper, it says, edited out Angela Merkel from front page on Paris March. It says a small Jewish ultra-Orthodox, this is being reported in The Guardian out of London, a small ultra-Orthodox newspaper, Hanverser, digitally removed female world leaders present at Sunday's Unity March after Charlie Hebdo attacks. It goes on to say a small Jewish ultra-Orthodox newspaper in Israel has found itself in the spotlight after digitally removing, German Chancellor Angela Merkel from a photo of this week's Paris March, which occurred on last Sunday. World leaders had linked arms to march in Paris against terrorism after Islamic extremists killed 17 people in those two attacks in Paris. It said at the march, Merkel stood in the front row between the French President Francois Hollande and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. But it said the readers of the Hanverser, newspaper Monday's edition didn't know that she had been digitally removed, leaving Abbas standing next to Hollande. Israeli media joked it was meant to bring Abbas closer to Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, who was standing nearby. Now, how do people think they can get by with stuff like that, okay? It said within this ultra-Orthodox community, pictures of women are rarely shown due to modesty concerns. That's what they're trying to lay it off as, and so forth. It said the picture in Hanverser also cut out other women like the Paris mayor and Hidalgo, though the newspaper clumsily left her dark glove on the sleeve of a marcher. Oh my gosh. So they didn't quite do a good job on shop removing it, Photoshop removing it. So, there you go. We're trying to make sense out of this and to have, newspapers cloud the issues and so forth. But anyway, there were these two attacks, and it killed about 17, and there are about 22 that are wounded. We're not reading much in our own newspapers about those that were wounded over there, but there were a number of wounded over there. Gary Mauser, we have up on our site an abstract, about a 64-page abstract of his over 600-page book and report about gun control and gun rights in European nations. And he's saying that the more stringent and the harsher the banning of weapons, the more violence there is with guns in those nations. Now, Turkish President Erdogan, after these shootings there, was accusing the Mossad of having done this. So, isn't that a howdy-do? I mean, the Mossad did this? Well, I don't know if there's, he has input, though, that we don't have. So you must listen to the president, and he's the president now of Turkey. We know that Turkey is Freemason rule by Freemasons. It started off with a takeover in the 20s, and that takeover consummated and resulted in a secular government being founded, by Ataturk and his fellow Masons. And so Turkey today is Masonic-based secular government, you could say. Now, what's interesting about some of Erdogan's statements about this is that he had to fight off an attack that was a culmination of the secret societies promulgating, in my opinion, an attack on him because he was too orthodox, far to the right, being a Muslim. And so he fought back and reordered a security council that they had over there and so forth. And today he moved from prime minister to the presidency of Turkey. Now, the appointments power that the Turkish president has is very great. In some ways, within the country, the president of Turkey is more powerful than the prime minister. The prime minister is the head executive over the legislative and over the government, executive government, while the president has appointment powers and so forth and wields a lot of power and economic might. They have a heck of a welfare system over there. So there's a lot of money going in to these special institutions that were set up years ago. Now, Ataturk, back in the 20s, when he took over with his military coup, he brought in a secular government with the five eras that he rests his whole government on. And it what it did, basically, was it separated the church from the state, and then that way the Masonic would rule outside of the Islam, say, religion. And that's basically how Turkey has been governed since the 20s. And today, if you look at Turkey from a Gladio viewpoint, I just want to say a few minutes, a few points here, comments about Gladio. If you haven't heard of Gladio before, quickly said, Gladio was a left behind, you could say, dark operations units that they've morphed it from a left behind type of operations in the Eastern Bloc countries to the NATO countries, and they were carrying out false flag operations to continue to keep a tension within those NATO countries, and it was promulgated to be anti-collective, anti-communism. But they backed socialist, democratic socialist type of regimes, but they would not back any communist regimes in those NATO countries. So it operated like that for years in most of those NATO countries. Well, one of the NATO countries that I've looked at more closely than others was Turkey. And Turkey had not only their Gladio program, but they had other very divisive and very dark underground operations going on that were very similar to Gladio, run by the government. Well, when Erdogan went in 2003, I believe, he had quite a resistance from the judiciary and military that had run all these programs to his new rule. And so they set out to unseat him, and this set off a plethora of investigations and indictments and so forth that his new government launched against these enemies. And I've got my article up there now. We're looking at Saturday night on the 17th tonight, but it's up there. So go in there to thesecrettruth.com, and you can read that article. And it's pretty insightful about Turkey and all the going-ons over there. You can't believe, after you read that article, you shake your head. I mean, when I was writing the article, I didn't know what I was going to end up with on that article. But it's mystifying to start with that a nation would be ruled by 300 Masonic lodges all over Turkey, but claim the dominance of the Islam religion. So anyway, that's very interesting to read my article and draw some conclusions and some further insights out of that. It's just sort of unheard of that something like that would be ongoing like that. But anyway, what has happened now in Paris and in France is that a sea change of public opinion, in my opinion, has changed because of these attacks by these jihadists claiming to be out of the Yemen Al-Qaeda Arabian Peninsula group. And it was certified, I mean, it was confirmed by that group over there that they had planned this for years, they said. They came on with a video and said, yeah, we planned these attacks for years. And so they claimed responsibility for those attacks, and that's going to be a very eye-opener for them when they start shooting those drones in there. And they have taken out some people already in Yemen with that drone activity. But this whole thing is becoming unraveled. Europe, the Germans are riled up against the Muslim population in Germany itself. I think it's primarily happening in formerly parts of East Germany, which it's consolidated now. It's been unified. But I think some of the strongest objection to the Muslim population is coming from the eastern part of Germany now. But there were big, big demonstrations in the Cologne area. Of Deutsch, that would be Köln, K-O-L-N, with the umlaut over the O. But anyway, and it was formerly the capital when East Germany and West Germany were separated in the two parts there, the East and West. the national capital was in Cologne, and it was in Kern, far west Germany. And then when they consolidated the east and west parts of Germany back into a unified Germany, then they moved the capital back to Berlin. And they have there in Berlin, they redone the Reichstag and so forth, and it's within short distance of the American embassy there. And when I was over there in West Berlin, you could view the Reichstag, but it was in ruins, and I believe it was right over in the East German side at that time, if I remember. There was a Russian war memorial there, right close to the wall, and you could stand there and look at the Reichstag in ruins at the time. They also left Kongresshalle in ruins down in Nuremberg, which was the contemplated meeting hall of the Nazis, but it was never finished. The perimeter building part of it was, but the inside of it was never finished, and it's still in ruins. But I think there's a local Nuremberg symphony group there occupying one corner of the building and for rehearsing and so forth and practice. But anyway, so ruins, some of the ruins that were, some of the buildings over there are still lying ruins, but the Reichstag has been rebuilt and it's being occupied now by the new parliament, German parliament. So we get back to this Paris thing. We just can't, make it any more important point that it has changed all of France. The day that this happened, the French Parliament, the lower house, had made a referendum vote. It was non-binding to support any new Palestinian initiative for statehood. And so that was something that came out of the French Parliament, the lower house, right at the same time that this happened. And so that's very, suspicious that in a way that this would happen about the same time that the French were beginning to be sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. And all of a sudden you have terrorists killing people in magazines and in kosher markets and so forth. There are some problems with this attack that people are making note of. And one of the problems is that there was an ID card left in the back of the car there of one of the terrorists. So they started IDing these two terrorists pretty quick, according to with that ID card. And then the third one that went into that kosher market, they had his name and ID down real quick, too, because he was related, and it's been proven now that they were. One of the ladies that survived in the shooting there in the magazine office, publishing house there of the magazine, was saying that someone that with blue eyes let her live, and because she was a woman. And then later on, that would be reported on news programs in Paris, in France. And then later on, when they released the two terrorists' mugshots, I didn't see any blue eyes. I think our local newspaper here in Austin, Texas, had one of them with blue eyes. One of the terrorists. So there's unanswered questions. Also, there's a problem. There are policemen, a high official that was investigating this on the special operations team, was preparing a report, and all of a sudden he comes up dead through suicide at his own desk in police headquarters with his own gun. I mean, that's preposterous, and not believing it, I'm sorry. Your police, your intelligence people over there are releasing the most absurd and preposterous explanations of his death that anyone could ever contrive and put together. Can't go for that. I don't think that that's the truth about the matter at all. See, but you'll have to go. We'll have that. We have that click off up on our site now. We're going to put this all up. We're going to put the Turkish article back up there. We've had it up there on other weekends, and we're going to put all of this other information up for you to take note of. This Gary Mauser gun control thing is important to click off on too. He's out of British Columbia, and he says that the more stringent, the more bans, the more strict the bans are that you have in Europe, the more gun violence that you have in Europe. this net neutrality that the president's been talking about end of this week, he's not talking about a net neutrality that was formulated under Clinton's administration. Back then, there was a peace treaty, so to speak, an agreement reached that the MPAA, which is the Motion Picture Association, that was trying to protect their copyrights, was saying that the thieving of their movies on and bootlegging and so forth that was going on was not to be tolerated. But they finally struck an agreement. Now they're coming back and they want a more highly regulated, internet, and to protect their movie rights and their copyrights of their movies and so forth. The other side of it is Google and all these people that want a true net neutrality situation. Obama's talking about net neutrality with some kind of a participation of the FCC. Now, that's not net neutrality by any means. So he's misleading somewhat when he's trying to describe the word net neutrality in accordance with, in conjunction with the FCC in any way. It just doesn't. It's not the same. It doesn't work that way. So we'll have to, that remains to be seen, how that will work out. But I am for true net neutrality. I think we need to leave the internet alone. What is behind the scenes on this is that the big money powers are realizing that the internet, that they helped create and bring about, okay, was a tremendous boom to business and economics and marketing, but also it got a lot of liberty ideas out there, and people love liberty. And Ron Paul and these kind of people started running for office, for high office as president and so forth. And before that, without the internet, they were not major contenders. But they became very serious contenders with the coterie of supporters that they could marshal over the internet, and all kinds of webcasts, live webcasts of their meetings and so forth were put out on the web, and it generated a lot of interest. So the elite out there, the big money powers, are out to close down to the freedom fighters and the liberty fighters, the internet, and they want to charge the heck out of them and tax them to death to run them out. That's what I see in these moves to regulate the internet. That's why we must resist any regulation of the internet whatsoever and leave it alone. And I believe under the Clinton administration, I think they had reached that agreement, and you can go look that up on the web. Crude is dropping. My gosh. It's down into the 40s, mid-40s now, and Harry Dent recently said on a talk show that it looks like that the support level is about $32 a barrel. So anyone out there that wants to protect their interest in the markets, in the crude markets, better start putting on some kind of a short position. If they're long on crude, they need to offset it with a short position. And you can ask your broker how to do that. But that would be good advice right now that I would give anyone. The Swiss franc. We've got to talk about the Swiss franc. What happened over there in Switzerland was that the Swiss National Bank, it ended the cap on the Swiss franc against the euro. They had maintained a certain cap on the value to keep the Swiss franc from rising dramatically. And when they took that off on Thursday, it was trading up as much as 35% over and above the value of the relationship to the euro. So the Swiss franc was appreciating tremendously over just a market day. And this upset many of the markets. The people that were short on the Swiss franc then got clobbered, because as it traded up in value, it was tripping off what they call stop loss orders. And a stop loss order, basically, if you were short on the Swiss franc, you would usually place a sell order on the other side, on the upside, to limit your loss. And many of the times when we have drastic moves like this, we're in the commodities or stock prices or whatever, and you get on the wrong side with the wrong position, and then you're tripped out. See, you have an automatic sell order in there, what they call a stop-loss order, and those are just automatically executed, and you've lost the difference between that and what you had originally purchased it for, see, on that upside, see. You were betting on the downside, and it went against you. So I would caution anyone that's speculating heavily, and I'm not a stockbroker or anything else. I have speculated in gold quite extensively in the past, so I know a little bit about some of these mechanisms, but you've got to be careful, and I'm not giving stock market advice or business advice here. I want to make that clear. The Swiss National Bank, some commentators are saying, did this and released that cap and took that cap off to anticipate a European Central Bank policy that will be announced probably next week in conjunction with the World Economic Forum of quantitative easing. The European Central Bank is unlike that of the Fed, where it can't do it directly, but it has to do it through bond purchases from the banks, member banks of the European Central Bank. So they intend to do that, and they're going to announce it next week. It might be in conjunction with the World Economic Forum. So that's something to watch. Now, this World Economic Forum will take place beginning next week, and you can check on it. The World Economic Forum, weforum.org, is the webcast address. Is the web address. Now, in there, they're going to be having videos of several of the panel discussions, and this is something very important to take note of. I would advise all my listeners to go in as much as they can. We've got about a seven-hour difference, see, between Davos, Switzerland, and Austin, Texas, or somewhere in the country, 6 to 7, 8, 9 hour difference, depending on which time zone you are here in the States, stateside here in the United States. But people that have time, retired people, go in there to the worldeconomicforum.org site, start listening to some of those videos, and record those videos if you can, either the video and audio together or just the audio alone for future replay like you would on a podcast and things like that. The World Economic Forum is going to be an important meeting. It comprises of well over 2,500 of the biggest corporate entities in the world, and so you must take note of that. They're pushing stuff like public-private partnerships. They want to draw upon an infinite credit line of the countries that they're operating in, and so this is what they push vigorously at their meetings, and that's what they want everyone to be receptive to, you could say. One thing that did happen in Switzerland just recently, this last Thursday, is sight deposits increased. Okay, now you're saying increase is usually a positive. No, this is a negative increase. But what that means, it went from a minus 0.25%. That means if you had money in the bank, you had to pay the Swiss bank that much to leave that money on deposit. It went from 0.25% to 0.75% negative, 0.75%. So it actually decreased and went down. It increased in a negative way, meaning there's a lower negative figure, meaning that what we're looking at in the future, and this is something that Gerald Celente and all these other people, commentators on economic, have made a point of over the last few weeks or months, is that we're looking at a possible deflationary economy, and you can have both a recession or a depression in a deflationary or an inflationary economy. It looks like that the way that this is headed now is on the deflationary side, okay? And since it's on the deflationary side, you're going to see a decline, see, in prices. Now, the crude, according to Harry Dent recently, he's saying that this decline in crude is not only the Saudi backed stuff. They're keeping up their production because they need the cash dollars, see. But the demand for crude overall worldwide is off, according to the latest figures. But so we could truly be going into there's a couple of plays here. You could say that the Saudis are doing along with the British in the United States and the Bush, you could say, dynasty and so forth. And that's that Russia right now is beginning to suffer from a decline of the crude. And also their ruble, their Russian ruble, has declined appreciably, well over 50 to 60% over this last 2014 year. So the Russians are looking at a declining ruble. They're looking at declining revenue, which about approximately 70% of their economy is reliant on sales of petrochemical, crude and so forth, and gas into Western Europe. This is where Merkel and them are having second thoughts about the sanctions that were recently placed upon Russia because of their problems with the Ukrainian area. And it looks like France and Germany together are going to resist further sanctions, and they might even start lobbying that group, that international group, for lifting those sanctions earlier than maybe the United States and the UK and so forth might want to do. It looks like that that's going to happen, you know, to me. It looks like that Merkel and them, Germany, is too dependent on natural gas to have those lifted that soon, those sanctions. I mean, excuse me, that they would be open to lifting the sanctions against Russia earlier than later. And I think France's economy is not that good, and they need the trade with Russia also. And so both of those countries, I think the sentiment within the top echelon of the government, prime ministers and presidential you know, offices, are to lift those sanctions earlier than later and ease up on these harsh sanctions against Russia. The United States and UK on a hard line. David Cameron just met with Obama yesterday, Friday, and they hammered out an agreement on cybersecurity and a much. I think they're going to hold the line on the sanctions on Russia. I think that's what it was about. But also, domestic terrorism was one of their focuses. Okay, so they're going to try to work closer together on what they call domestic terrorism, and they're going to use the these recent you know, attacks, not only in Paris, there were two, and then there was a third one in the Brussels, Belgium area. So that was just another two terrorists that were taken out there. So the idea that it's beginning to spread in Europe, see, is catching on. And so that's giving rise to a crackdown on the Muslim communities. And so you have Germany, you know, that's had these large, you know, demonstrations. And then now the French were sympathetic to the Palestinian state. But this thing today is going to create a mind change somewhat of an attitude in change in viewing the Muslim community, not only in France, but especially in Germany. And it's going to be negative toward their whole cozying up, you could say, to Western Europe. The jihadists are coming in there, and it's suspect that these Paris attacks, in my opinion, were a minimal agent provoked. Agent provocateurs, I think, were operating, and it could culminate, it could come out, fall out to be a false flag operation purposely carried out to create this change in the French population that was more, you could say, pro-Israel, pro-Israeli, and less pro-Palestinian or pro-Arab. So that could very well have been the techniques and the outcome that might result here from these attacks in Paris and Belgium. Okay. The Swiss franc, we've gotten through that. Okay, another information here that we need to get into. Transnationalism. Transnationalization or transnationalism, okay? It first started out, I know I'm preaching to the choir here on some of these. Some of my listeners out there are pretty sophisticated. They've already heard some of the multinational stuff I've said before, but let's pick up on some of our newer listeners here. The multinational was a description that described an international corporation operating in multiple nations, and that was the term multinational. That was morphed and changed as gradually the management of these international corporations began to take on more and more international managers and executives from all over the world. Then they started calling them transnationals. Well, what's happening now, there's been a recent change in the Ukraine that allows foreigners to hold high positions in the government. And what that is doing is it's transnationalizing, you could say, the Ukraine. Now, this is something for us to watch, and it's very, very important to take note of this, okay, and see how that's going to work out overall. We have Naomi Klein up in Toronto, okay, writing books, and she's an anti, you could say, globalization, or anti, yeah, she's against globalization, period. Yes, Naomi Klein had several books out, and a very interesting person. I met her in 2010 in Toronto, and she's best known for her No Logo. It was a book that went on to become an international bestseller. Now, she followed that up with two additional books, The Shock Doctrine, A Critical Analysis of the History of Neoliberal Economics. And their latest book is The Changes, the latest book is this, entitled This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate, a New York Times nonfiction bestseller. So that's what she's into now. I would take note of that. She's a university graduate of the University of Toronto. She's Canadian. She's heavily on the anti-capitalism, environmentalism side. She's anti-globalism, earlier grandfather, grandmother connected to communism groups there in Canada. And I believe her books are very informative. I believe I would like to see more on the side of financing and banking and things like that. And that's really where the globalists are coming from in her books. She uses the word capitalism, as a bad word. But it's crony capitalism, and she knows that too. But it's more than just crony capitalism. It's a banking system that has developed of usury and so forth, along with crony capitalism. So it's monopolistic capitalism that we've been talking about, Charlotte Littlefield and I've been talking about for years here. Now it's beginning to catch on. Facebook, there are different people putting up citations and notations and addresses on crony capitalism. So that's becoming a common word. Two additional words would be monopolistic capitalism and Babylonian capitalism, which were both, we're talking about a real monopoly of money creation. And when you can create money from out of thin air and you have a monopoly on it, you've got a really tremendous profit. Getting back to Naomi, she wrote a book called The No Logo. She used to hang out in shopping centers when she was a young girl, and she was into logos, and finally she got into consumerism, and hey, that logo thing is a real problem. And then some of those companies are overseas are using, not slave labor, but child labor and so forth. And so she started dissing that. She was born in Montreal, Quebec, brought up in a Jewish family with a history of peace activism. I met her in Toronto in 2010. And her parents were war resistors to the Vietnam War, and so forth and so on. And, anyway, she's an interesting person to take note of, those books that she's written. We don't always agree on everything, but overall, I think she's trying to do the right thing and trying to, put a spotlight on capitalism. I would call it crony capitalism, if anything. So just to finish up on this transnationalism, is that what's happening in that area is that the nations, to subdue them to the internationalist and the money power, you've got to change the sovereignty type of relationship to their citizens. And I believe that's exactly what's going on, is that if you can't induce into those nations new laws that that allow internationalists to come in and occupy high levels in the government, then what you've done is you've transnationalized those governments from sovereign nation states to transnational states. And I think that's clearly what is going on there. I saw today, day Saturday, I attended a movie earlier, The Imitation Game, okay? And the focus of it was Alan Turing, which was a mover and shaker in deciphering the Nazi enigma and, encrypted messages. The Nazis were using the machine called the Enigma, and this whole program was set up by the British under the name Ultra, you know. And Ultra Secret is what it stands for, but the program was to break the Nazi codes during World War II to render to the Allies more insight into the Nazis' strategy and moves and so forth during World War II. There were times when the British, to keep the, they finally culminated, Alan Turing finally created a machine. It's a big machine. It was like a first computer, but it had these different rotors and everything built into it, much like the machine that the Nazis had. The British had a copy. They had one, but they're in their secret. The Bletchley Park was the location of the Ultra program, a deciphering station and special secret program, Ultra Secret. The British were operating during World War II. And so Bletchley Park is where the movies primarily takes place. And it features and focuses in on Alan Turing, who was a mathematical genius. And that's why they first recruited him into the program to help break the Nazis' codes. The Nazi codes were not that easy to break, and he had to build a whole machine. And he started asking for £100,000 from the British government. Then it went to I think it got up to £300,000, what he had invested there, and they wanted results, okay? So one of the things in the movie that was interesting was that they had a number of people working there, decrypting and working on different codes on different levels of different types of military units. And so as a result, they had this, they were stuck, and they were only given 1 month to they had not deciphered any code with this big machine that they had invested hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of pounds into. So they were given 1 month as a deadline. And so they were sitting in this bar, and this one lady, decoder, you know, happened to mention that at the beginning of every message that she was working on was Hi Hitler. And so Turing jumps up. He said, "That's it." And he had a mind, you know, a great realization there. And what they went back to the machine and put into there and started looking for that at the beginning of their messages. And then they could see that was at the beginning. And then that made the rest of the message decipherable. But it was quite an amusing movie. And I want to thank Scotty for helping me get through that. It was a wiring nightmare, and he did build a machine that did do it. And it broke the Nazi code for World War II, and it probably resulted in at least millions of lives saved, probably. There's estimates of maybe 1 to 2 million lives were saved by the breaking of the codes. And then the question of, would we have won the war without it? Well, we had the Manhattan Project of a nuclear device that we dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we had the ultimate weapon there. But it would have been a much more drawn out campaign, probably, in France and so forth. And we did use the secret, our ability to decode their messages to keep secret where we would land, and we landed in Normandy on D-Day, and that was kept a pretty good secret. The Nazis were actually directed towards further to the north there along the coast, and that helped us get enough men in 3 to 5 days. We had enough men and materials on the beach moving inward, and we had established a bridgehead, which resulted in our winning the war. And also, though, of course, we had more munitions, we had more supplies, more guns, more, you know, planes, everything, compared to what Nazi Germany had at the time. What's interesting also is that in Poland, in the 30s, in the early 30s, the Poles were working on breaking the Enigma code. But they were working on it, and this gets back to the Imitation Game, the movie I saw, referring to Alan Turing and the breaking of the code at Bletchley Park there. Okay, but the Poles had been working on breaking the code for a number of years because the machine was part of the German military before the war broke out, but they couldn't do it. So, but they felt like that the solution to breaking the code rested on mathematics and algorithms. And so the British, right before the war started, and when it's still peacetime and they could get through on train, sent a two-man team in to talk to the Polish decipherers, encryption specialists that they had. And so as a result, the two British agents were convinced that, yes, the solution lay on the mathematics algorithm side, not on the linguist side. Before then, the British effort had been primarily on the linguistic side of code breaking and had ignored somewhat the algorithm mathematics of encryption. And eventually, they recruited Alan Turing into their project at Bletchley Park. He was a mathematical genius, and he helped put this machine together. The machine, much like a computer, but it simulated somewhat the encryption machines that the Germans were using. And that's what it finally resulted in them having the ability to do what they needed to do and to decipher those codes. The second hour you should take note of is going to be a rebroadcast of a book, an interview that I had, with Eric Williams Towle, T-O-W-L-E. It's pronounced Towle. And the name of the book was Uprising of the Human Spirit. And basically, he says in there that this is his, you could say, summary or synopsis of it. And here we go. The social order today constitutes a kind of invisible prison for your mind built to ensure compliance to a central power. There is a way out. This book contains a map. This book is about the evolution of consciousness through history in relationship to the rise and fall of civilizations and your place in that dynamic right now. He said, he goes on, we're living in an age where consciousness has evolved faster than civilization has progressed. This happens because those who have made their way to the top of the pyramids of power attempt to thwart all change that would threaten their dominance. This leaves the individual trapped between two opposing forces. On the one side is a society deliberately dumbed down and manipulated to support an entrenched elite. And on the other side is the individual's own rising mind capable of creating a far better world. This condition is pandemic in society today. It leaves people feeling a vague sense of being strangely out of place, as if they don't fit the world they were born into. He has taken this integral theory of Jean Gerbser, a social historian of immense genius, and integrated his penetrating insight into the evolution of consciousness with the political science of Carol Quigley, a past master in the study of evolving civilizations. From this meeting of these two minds together, Towle has found a path through the labyrinth of power leading to the liberation of the modern mind. Lost and forgotten human capacities are reintroduced to the reader along with an emerging consciousness that offers a freedom untouchable by grasping power. As the old corrupt civilization falls, a new world arises. In this book is the beginning of a revolution, the uprising of the human spirit. That's what Eric Williams Towle has to say about his book. and that's a rebroadcast. I met him out in California on a secret space program out there at San Mateo in the middle of the summer. So that's something to take note of there. We pretty well have covered most of the points tonight. There are other, there's additional news that's happening right now. I believe that right now would be the time for me to expand on the World Economic Forum just a little bit, okay? The World Economic Forum will take place beginning at the end of next week. I encourage you to go in there, look at the videos and so forth, and that's for darn sure. And then it has the movers, shakers, and the corporate, you could say, institutions throughout the world, and they are something to really take note of, and you can learn a great deal of what they're going to do. The High Court, Supreme Court, is going to decide about gay marriage later, and, the scientists, the NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmosphere Agency, says that we're in for that we've had the warmest 2014 ever. Your opponents of that are saying no, it's the it's only one of 34 of the warmest for U.S. So you've got that contention that's about global warming and global climate change and so forth that continually will go on and on. Obama met with David Cameron. They hammered out this domestic terrorism deal. But he says in his statements at his press conference on Friday that he would not veto any new sanctions against Iran. Oh, excuse me. He says, I will veto any new sanctions against Iran. So he's not for imposing on Iran any greater sanctions than exist right at this time. So that would be pro-Islam there. And people have accused him of being too pro-Islam. Now, what's happening, too, though, behind the scenes is Netanyahu's had his differences with Obama. And the difference is, center around Iran to a great deal. The Israeli state has wanted an attack for years on Iran to take down their nuclear capability. They feel that their nuclear power capability is going to be expanded into nuclear weapons capability. So Netanyahu has had his differences, you could say very great differences, with Obama in the last few years. And there had been a little backbiting going on back and forth. Now, this cropping out of the Merkel and them out of that Israeli paper didn't help things either, for the Israelis that were publishing that. They're saying, well, the women are not emphasized in their publications and so on. But that was something to check into. Go to our site. Also, we'll have information on the policeman committed suicide during the Paris attacks, you could say, and that's highly suspicious. There's also in there, the first article said that there was a previous police official that preceded him that also had committed suicide at his desk with his own gun. So, I mean, that's fishy. You have too many things that are not straightforward. An idea in the back seat of one of the, jihadist, attackers. You've got this one that says blue eyes, and maybe they didn't have it or they didn't. I don't know the bottom line on that one yet. We don't know for sure. But anyway, you're getting differences of statements. And that's what happens on this. I believe right now I can state, in my own opinion, that the Paris attack, there are jihadists in some of these groups anyway, and it doesn't take much to set them off. The Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula are taking credit for it and saying they planned these years ahead. That's not necessarily true. But many of these agent provocateurs will penetrate groups such as these Muslim groups in Paris and activate them by egging them on and getting them riled up, Well, they shouldn't teach you that way. You're a Muslim. You've got rights. You can all this. And before you know it, some of these people that are not very stable, that are really jihadists. We're talking about real terrorism here, folks. I'm not saying the thing in France it was evil, and it was carried out by Muslims that were members of the Muslim community. Now, what motivated them to do that would be their religion, but also were they provoked by some of their fellow Muslims that didn't have the best ulterior motives in store, you know. So that's what happens, is that you have people that have been infiltrated that are working for the government, and they're Muslims, and they activate these people by hyping them up and getting them all riled up against the so-called Jewish community and so forth. And this is what is so tragic in many of these cases, is where you have these groups that are just terrible. Okay, the second hour is going to be the uprising, and I want you to listen to that if you have time. This is thesecrettruth.com. I'm George Butler, along with Charlotte Littlefield. She's off tonight. We broadcast here in Austin, Texas on 90.1 FM every Saturday night from 7 to 9. Our format here lately has been the first hour of fresh broadcasting from 7 to 8. And then we usually will rebroadcast a very interesting hour that many of our listening audience has expressed in wanting to hear again. And that's where we've come up with some of these very, very insightful insights, you know, and so forth. The hedge funds had spectacular losses in Switzerland when Swiss Central Bank took off of that cap on the relationship between the Swiss franc and the euro. Then there were tremendous losses on the negative side, on the downside, or on the short position there. So there was a tremendous amount of money lost on that. And that's where people have inside information, so to speak, and that know when these moves are going to be made by a central bank, can make just tremendous profits. Reviewing again, we went through the attacks in Paris. We're talking about transnationalism being a mechanism. Oh, now what holds true on the transnationalism angle too is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And look at that, and on the web, and there's an authority on that out of Canada. I forget. I'll have to add that to our site. It's not up yet, but I'll add her as the authority on that idea. Actually, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, she's heading up an organization out of Canada that's adamantly against that partnership agreement. But basically, what I want to say about that is that partnership agreement is being used, but in a different way, to override state-nation sovereignty. And what they're doing there is they're making all these agreements with all these corporate transnationals, you could say, and then that overrides the constitutional law that governs those business relationships. So what they're trying to do is, through an administrative hierarchy within the corporate community, override the nation business law, and that's ongoing, and that's very dangerous. And this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has been, information about it has been withheld from our Congress. So go look into that. We want to thank you very much for listening tonight, and we appreciate each and every one of you. And we're out for freedom. We're out to get down to the secret truth and find out what's really going in this country. And we're scared to death about America and the destruction of what's good in this country. So go come back into thesecrettruth.com. Send us your email, and spread the word about what we're trying to do here on the good side. And we're actually on the good side, trying to do the right thing.